that's a good point. I will come to another point, according to which we have, I mean, a good number of scholars, philosophers, who also, I mean, they have searched about all these reasons for belief in God, and they have brought about many intellectual arguments to
right.
prove the existence of God.
Right.
The other point is that if the only factor for people believing in God is fear, and it has nothing to do with intellect, then another question is that, so what about the animals? I mean, the animals, they also have fear, and for sure they may not know the cause for their fears. But can we claim that the animals also believe in God because of the fact that they are fearful of many things and they do not know the reason,
right.
so they need to attribute it to a divine cause? My point is that there is a big difference that between human beings and animals that these scholars, they do not, they ignore, and that is the fact that human beings enjoy the faculty of intellect. So if it is only about fear, animals also have many causes for fear. So we need to, according to this argument, we need to conclude that the animals, all of them, they are, I mean, believers in God because they are fearful of God.
Or but in some gods or whatever they
yeah,
see.
Yeah.
Right.
At least it's not proved yet.
Right.
So it means that there is a big difference between the animals and human beings, and the human beings, they have, the faculty of intellect, and through that they are able to prove the existence of God. Now, let me give you an example, because sometimes people, when these people mention this claim that fear is the cause and the origin of the religion, they want to call religion a kind of superstition.
Right.
And the fact that people do not know about some causes for their fears, for example, now they know, say, so they need to remove and put aside that superstition. They call that, for example, some people believe that horseshoe is auspicious, for example, as a kind of superstition, and some people keep it
right.
in their houses. So they want to make a kind of similarity between belief in God and that belief that horseshoe is auspicious.
Just like the superstition that we have in the US about the rabbit's foot, it brings luck. So they keep a rabbit's foot.
Yeah.
So they say that religion is all superstition then.
Yeah.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
I would like to mention that there is a big difference between the two, between horseshoe is auspicious and there is a God.
Right.
There is a big difference. And the difference is that when we ask these scholars that we have two sentences, horseshoe is, auspicious, and 2 + 2 = 4. Are these two the same? The answer is, of course not. Now, the point is that when it comes to belief in God, beside, talking about the origin of that, we have so many arguments mentioned by the scholars to prove that.
We use logic to prove his
exactly.
existence.
So we cannot say that it is exactly like that superstition of the horseshoe or
right.
the rabbit's foot
right.
that you mentioned. There is a big difference. When it comes to belief in God, we have a great number of scholars from different backgrounds, different religions. They have mentioned many arguments to believe in a God, of different religions. So we cannot say that it is just a superstition like the horseshoe or
right.
the rabbit's foot.
As a superstition, it has no logical reasoning.
Exactly.
It's just something that people believe on their
mm-hmm.
own. Right.
So having said that, I come to mention that we see a great number of scholars from different religions. They have, brought many arguments, all of them being intellectual. So we should not think that all the philosophers in the West and in the East, they do not believe in God. All of them are atheists. This is not the case. In Judaism, in Christianity, in Islam, and in almost all the religions, we have philosophers who believe in God, and they bring philosophical and intellectual arguments to prove the existence of God. We do not have enough time to explain
right.
about all those arguments.
No, unfortunately not.
Yeah, in Christianity, we have so many arguments. And maybe from time to time they are updated. We have new versions of them.
Right.
When it comes to the religion of Islam, we have so many arguments mentioned by, some of them are mentioned only by Muslim theologians, some of them by Muslim philosophers, and some of them by both. So the point is that point that need to be taken into consideration is the fact that when it comes to belief in God, it's not a superstition, because there is a big difference between that and the horseshoe.
Right.
And the difference is that we have enough arguments, intellectual arguments. The next point is that if fear is the cause for belief in religion, the conclusion might be that the religious people should be the most fearful and coward people in the history, because the cause for their belief in God is fear.
Right.
And then, so it requires them being coward people, fearful people of many things. But the reality is completely different. We see that in different religions, those who believe in God, because of the fact that they rely on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when it comes to our religion, we see different examples of our prophet, Imam Ali alayhi salam, and the companions of the prophet, Muslims, during the history of Islam. They were not fearful of worldly causes.
Right.
And, they were among the most,
at ease, people, relaxed, and moderns and really troubled by the worldly affairs.
Exactly. So this is another, at least, indication to tell us that this is, big lie to claim that fear has been the cause
it's
for them.
It's a false conclusion to this thought.
Yeah. The other point is that if fear is the cause for belief in God, it requires the religions and the religious scriptures to encourage people to fear,
right,
and promote the idea of fear. I'm talking about fear in its negative sense. We need to fear, the punishment of our actions. But we see that when it comes to our religion, for example, there are many narrations which talk against the concept of al-jubn, which is, fear in the negative sense of the word. To fear different causes and the fact that we need to rely on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and not to fear. So if the cause and origin of a religion like Islam is fear, then it requires the religion to ask people to be more fearful,
right,
and not to rely on God, and not to be courage enough to be resistance against these causes.
True Islam also wouldn't remain if it was only based on fear. It is Islam. It's meant it remained because it is peaceful. People like being Muslims,
yeah,
not because they like being fearful of, I don't know, rain or thunder.
Mm-hmm. So the kind of fear that these scholars talk about is a kind of fear that is rejected in at least many religions, like the religion of Islam. So when it comes to fearing the enemy, I don't know, the thunder, these are rejected kinds of fear in at least some religions, or many
right.
religions, especially Islam. So if it was the cause for religion, naturally, logically, Islam should have encouraged people to be more fearful so that they would be more religious.
Right.
But we see that this is not the case. Rather, Islam encourages people to rely on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and be away from these kinds of fears.
And on that note, I thank you, dear Sheikh, for his time, and I thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. Yet again, this has been your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, coming to you from your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
إن في الجنة نهرا لبن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن علي لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى محن
Around the World with Reporters. The visit of Qatar's foreign minister is the latest in a series of visits undertaken by foreign dignitaries to Pakistan in recent days. Following the visits of foreign ministers of Germany, Italy, UK, and Netherlands, the visit of Qatar's top diplomat also focused on Afghanistan. His visit comes just days after the Afghan Taliban announced an interim government that drew criticism from certain Western countries for ignoring the demands of inclusive setup. Speaking at a joint news conference, Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi said the immediate priority must be the well-being of the people of Afghanistan.
And the most important thing that we both agree to is that we have to protect the interests of the people of Afghanistan. And for that, their safety, their security, stability, and to ensure that this Afghanistan, you know, does not become an arena for, you know, for proxy wars.
Since the Taliban took over, there have been fears of economic meltdown as the international financial institutions and Western countries suspended the assistance.
Humanitarian situation and humanitarian assistance should be independent from any political progress, because we believe that the Afghan people deserve to be helped, deserve to be supported, despite what's happening in the political landscape.
The Qatari foreign minister said the inclusive government is important for the unity of Afghanistan. The interim government announced by the Taliban was contrary to the commitment they made earlier that the political dispensation would be inclusive and broad-based. The interim government is set to take oath on the 20th anniversary of 9/11 attacks in the United States. Many countries are closely watching the Taliban whether they live up to the promises. But Pakistan and Qatar maintain that the world community should not take any steps that may aggravate the problems for the people of Afghanistan. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Palestinians organized several rallies in the Gaza Strip in solidarity with Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, where tensions mounted as Israeli regime began to practice a brutal crackdown on Palestinian prisoners and transfer them to new facilities. Palestinian inmates set fire to cells protesting the Israeli violent measures against them that have doubled after six Palestinian inmates gave Jalbu prison early this week.
Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails have been facing a war crime, especially after the heroic escape by six Palestinian inmates from Jalbo prison. Israel has adopted violent measures against Palestinian detainees, including solitary confinement.
Palestinian resistance factions called prisoners to resist these attempts to transfer them to various facilities, describing the condition in Israeli jails as war crime that requires urgent move to protect the Palestinian detainees. Palestinian Prisoners Club warned that tension would escalate between Palestinian detainees and the Israeli regime over the relocating of some detainees from the Islamic Jihad movement, as most of the six inmates are affiliated with the group.
The Palestinian resistance has a clear message that any Israeli attack threatening the lives of the prisoners will lead to serious consequences, and the Israeli regime will pay a heavy price for any violation. Our Palestinian resistance is ready to defend our detainees. Also, it's a national Palestinian duty to provide safety for the six heroes who have escaped the Israeli prison.
Palestinians called the international community and human rights groups to make serious actions in order to protect the Palestinian detainees from the Israeli violence.
We hope that all Palestinian detainees will be free soon. We are here to support our inmates. We won't remain silent amid the international community's apathy towards the issue. We will raise our voices against the international conventions that are only written on paper with no practical results.
Six Palestinian inmates escaped from the high-security Jilbu prison in northern parts of the occupied territories on Monday, prompting a massive manhunt by Israeli army. Along with its manhunt for six Palestinian detainees, the Israeli army has practiced violent measures against detainees inside jails. Palestinians here say they can't remain silent as the prisoners' issue is among their top priorities. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The British government has come under renewed condemnation after failing to honour their pledge to define Islamophobia 2 years after making the initial promise, with MPs and critics all condemning the lack of action amid rising Islamophobia across the UK. An all-party parliamentary group on British Muslims created their own definition of Islamophobia in 2018, describing it as a form of racism.
Islamophobia is rooted in racism and is a type of racism that targets expressions of Muslimness or perceived Muslimness.
Regardless which political group makes the definition, grassroots British Muslim groups are concerned over what they see as an establishment-pushed definition.
The best case scenario for this definition of Islamophobia would be one that forces the government to critically self-reflect and critically analyse its policies and policies of previous governments that have led to Islamophobia. I do specifically mean the so-called counter-extremism policies, which have just been a thinly veiled excuse to surveil the Muslim community. And these policies have had such detrimental impacts on the mental and physical well-being of the Muslim community. It's so likely we're going to have a watered-down definition that is nothing more than empty words. Why? Because there's been no engagement with the grassroots of society. There's been no engagement with organisations like ours, like MPAC UK, or CAGE, or MEND, or, critically, active massages like Lewisham Islamic Centre. There's been no engagement with organisations like these which have had to deal with the mess created by 20 years of suspicion and policies and institutionalized Islamophobia.
Some have already begun to adopt the definition, including the opposition Labour Party. However, accusations of Islamophobia within Labour remain, despite its implementation.
A lot of scepticism still surrounds this definition, with many fearing that it will ultimately fail to serve the community effectively, if at all. However, while MPs continue to procrastinate on the issue, Islamophobia remains a very real and persistent threat on both a street and systemic level. Robert Carter, London.
For the first time in 10 years, the Syrian army has entered Dar al-Balad in Daraa city. This is an implementation of a long negotiated deal with armed men that collapsed many times because of their violations. 9 checkpoints for the Syrian army have been established to ensure security after 900 armed men reconciled and surrendered their arms. Russian military police is also there, patrolling and supervising the deal's implementation. The Syrian flag was also raised on Al-Manshiya Police Department inside, signaling the return of law and order to the area.
Today, Dar al-Balad returns to Syria with efforts of people and security forces. Reconciliation talks have been successful. The armed forces and police have entered the town and 9 security checkpoints have been established.
The government's control over Dar al-Balad will lead to the reopening of public institutions and providing basic services to the residents, as well as reconstruction.
As you can see, security and stability have been restored. The town has a strategic location along Syria's border with Jordan. The restoration of public services is highly important for the residents of Dar al-Balad.
Meanwhile, Al-Mukhayyam Quarter remains under the control of armed groups who refuse any peaceful deal with the government, similar to some villages west of Dar'a. Thousands of people who left the town before a peaceful deal were allowed to return to their homes, marking the end of yet another chapter of an armed conflict in Syria. The military regaining control of Dar'a al-Balad is a testament to what Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has said time and again, that the army is determined to retake every inch of Syrian territory. After 10 years of war, the government continues to prioritize peaceful solutions to end any conflict like the one here in Dar al-Balad. Hamad Ali, Dar al-Balad, southern Syria.
The healthcare system in Yemen is deteriorating due to the ongoing Saudi blockade that has led to a harsh shortage of fuel. Sana Health Bureau said 100 health facilities had to stop providing health services partially or completely due to their inability to generate power anymore.
The fuel cuts in our country due to the blockade and aggression have affected the ability of health facilities to provide the necessary health services to our people. Our hospital has been negatively affected so that we have no way but to increase the charge of our services, and this constitutes an additional burden on Yemenis, especially amid the war and siege.
A civilian maternal hospital in Yemen's capital Sana'a used to have 45,000 liters of diesel each month as a grant from the World Health Organization. However, the world body, the hospital said, has stopped its fuel grant due to what it says, financial problems.
We are Sabreen Hospital in Sana'a. It is the referral hospital for maternity and the childhood disease. We are before we received oil from the WHO during 2021. The amount of the oil received to the hospital is become decreased to the fourth. The amount already we receive it. It is big catastrophe. It will lead to the death of the many. Child and woman, especially that admitted in the ICU, in the nursery, and the OT. Here in the hospital, we decrease most of our services to decrease the use of the electricity.
Earlier, Yemen's petroleum company said only 3 oil ships were allowed to arrive at Hudaydah port since the beginning of 2021, covering only 3% of what is required to fulfill the basic needs of Yemenis. The Saudi war and the blockade have led Yemen to the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations.
Yemen's healthcare system is on the verge of collapse as a result of the years-long Saudi war and the blockade. Yemen has also blamed the United Nations for their suffering, saying the world body should take real measures against the continuous Saudi violations of their rights. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
French President Macron announced recently that the Operation Barkhane in the Sahel region, especially in Mali, will be reshaped before the end of the year. Barkhane is a French military operation that started in 2014 in 5 Sahel countries, Mauritania, Niger, Burkina Faso, Chad and Mali, officially to fight against Al-Qaeda and Daesh-affiliated groups. In the beginning, French officials considered it as a success, but 7 years later, they admit that they have failed. Macron blames the Sahel states for the failure.
We cannot secure regions sliding back into lawlessness.
because the states decide not to take the responsibilities. That's impossible.
But are the Sahel states the only ones to blame? Is the stalemate in Mali not the result of the failure of French neocolonial policy in the region? Fact is that years after the French military intervention began, Mali is today divided in two, with the Malian state very little present in the north, where radical rebel groups control large parts of the country. So why did France intervene?
France has decided to intervene in the Sahel and in Mali to preserve its influence in the region. The French diplomacy was convinced that the status of France in the UN Security Council depended from the support of the Sahel countries. It guaranteed France of almost 30 extra votes in the UN General Assembly in support of its diplomacy.
But now France is getting bogged down in Mali, titles the monthly newspaper Le Monde Diplomatique. That's why France reshapes its military presence. 2,500 soldiers instead of 5,000. The new operation is called Takuba. Eventually, other European countries may join the French, but they are reluctant. Nobody wants to be humiliated as the USA have recently been in Afghanistan. The French neocolonial policy in the region is not anymore what it was. The central command of the Takuba Task Force will now be in Niger instead of Mali. That's not a coincidence. Niger has important uranium mines essential to feed the nuclear power plants in France. The Barkhane operation in Mali is coming to its end, but in fact it will continue under another name and by other means with the same hidden goal, to protect the economic interests of France in the region. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
NATO has just concluded its 17th annual arms control conference with harsh criticism directed towards authorities in Moscow, Beijing, Pyongyang and Tehran. NATO, led by the United States, continues to spend billions on military hardware, but clearly does not like it when nations outside the alliance develop their own defense capabilities.
There are also other players fielding nuclear weapons and advanced missile systems. North Korea and Iran, for example, are blatantly ignoring or breaking the global rules.
Iran has always stressed its nuclear program is purely peaceful. In fact, Tehran did all in its power to reassure the international community by signing up to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in 2015. It was the United States under Donald Trump that illegally withdrew from that nuclear accord. Stoltenberg failed to mention this once during his speech. In any case, experts say NATO is not in a position to point the finger. There are significant divisions within the 30-nation alliance. Its credibility is currently at rock bottom, critics argue, following its 20-year-long mission in Afghanistan.
The European member states of NATO will need to come up with real arguments to demonstrate that NATO makes values. You need to demonstrate the return on investment.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, concluded his address to the Arms Control Conference with these words.
You can count on NATO's commitment to security and stability.
That statement will likely cut to the bone for any Afghan citizen able to hear it. Anti-war campaigners say the destruction NATO countries brought to Afghanistan during the past two decades cannot be put into words. And now those Afghan civilians who somehow managed to survive have no idea what the future holds. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have celebrated the escape of six Palestinian inmates from Israeli maximum security Jabal prison in north of the occupied territories through a tunnel dug in the floor. Palestinians hailed the heroic operation and handed out candies to celebrate what they call a heroic move. Palestinian factions consider the escape as a slap in the face of the Israeli regime.
This operation is a great victory for our Palestinian prisoners, the resistance, and our Palestinian people. What happened in Jabal prison is unique. Our inmates grabbed their freedom by themselves, leaving the Israeli security defeated and confused. We are celebrating this victory as we call on all Palestinians to provide safety for those inmates.
Prisoners' groups said four of the inmates were serving life sentences. Another man was held under a special detention order, and the sixth was awaiting a verdict. Five of them belong to the Islamic Jihad movement, and one is a former commander in Fatah Party.
This escape has damaged the image of the Israeli regime before the world. It is such a great victory for Palestinians. We warn the Israeli regime against doing any action that puts the lives of those heroes at risk.
Palestinian resistance movements emphasized that the struggle for freedom with the Israeli occupation persists both behind bars and outside.
This is the biggest prison break in the history of the Palestinian cause, and it's going to be a remarkable incident in history. As Palestinian resistance, we hail these inmates' efforts of grabbing back their freedom and breaking the Israeli chains. We warn Israel not to hurt those prisoners, or else this will cost the Israeli regime a lot.
Palestinians have praised the heroic escape of the Palestinian inmates, describing it a blow to the Israeli regime and its security. They also stressed that the resistance is the only way to defend their rights and liberate their lands. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Voices of dissent outside Europe's biggest weapons fair, euphemistically called Defense and Security Equipment International, DSEI. More than 37,000 delegates descending on the British capital this year for a close encounter of the military kind, with more than 1,700 companies and dozens of governments here to buy or sell. Some are offering surveillance equipment, other manufacturers marketing all manner of lethal hardware, among them those who profited immensely from the so-called war on terror. The UK claims that it's leading the way in ethical arms sales.
We have a procedure that follows the consolidated criteria that is very clear around humanitarian law. We have in place a rigorous and robust process.
That is a claim dismissed by groups such as Stop the Arms Fair. They say by hosting the weapons show, Britain is perpetuating conflict and putting profit before human lives.
This arms fair wouldn't happen without the UK's support, the government's support. The defence and security exports team of the government makes sure that this arms fair happens. They know that human rights abusing countries are coming here to buy weapons that are made by UK companies and also foreign companies that we host in our country.
Campaigners also point out that several countries specifically invited here, such as the UAE, Egypt, and Bahrain, are on the UK government's human rights watch list.
The fact that we're hosting such hideous weaponry and we are actually inviting oppressive regimes and dictatorships to come and buy this weaponry, knowing that it will be used against the people of Palestine, knowing it's going to be dropped on the heads of the people of Yemen, is appalling.
In recent years, short of 60% of British arms exports have gone to the Middle East, accounting for billions of dollars in sales. Most of that business has gone to Saudi Arabia, which, according to many rights groups, has killed hundreds of thousands of civilians in indiscriminate airstrikes in Yemen.
Since 2015, the UK government has approved hundreds of arms export licenses to Saudi Arabia, worth more than $9 billion. Of that figure, nearly $2 billion came between July and September last year, after a court here rejected a legal challenge to ban weapon sales to the kingdom, a move slammed by critics as immoral.
The UK also sells record amounts of arms to Israel, lending support to Tel Aviv's militarized repression of Palestinians. Campaigners in Britain's political opposition are calling for an immediate change in government policy. But while they point out a shift in public opinion in recent years, the arms fair and the multi-billion dollar worldwide industry that drives it shows every sign of growing. Saeed Pariza, London.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Researchers say coronavirus is more contagious and more lethal than influenza, and we lack the same global protection mechanism. We have prepared for you an article written by Ian Sample. The piece is titled, Why Living with COVID Would Not Be the Same as Flu. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. England prepares to ease coronavirus restrictions further, the messaging from ministers has changed. They said, it seems we have reached a tipping point in the pandemic where rules will be replaced by personal decisions. The mantra now is about living with coronavirus, much as we do with seasonal flu. The pandemic has invited countless comparisons between coronavirus and influenza, and the diseases do have some features in common. Both are contagious, potentially lethal respiratory viruses. They can spread through aerosols, droplets, and contaminated surfaces. And they share some of the same symptoms in the form of fever, cough, headaches, and fatigue. In the winter ahead, one challenge the NHS staff face is separating the COVID patients from the flu cases. But there are striking differences between coronavirus and flu as well, and these matter very much for public health. Coronavirus spreads faster than influenza and can cause far more serious illness. The symptoms of coronavirus can take longer to show, and people tend to be contagious for longer, making them more prone to passing it on. Seasonal influenza has been around long enough that previous infection and protection from vaccines bear down on cases and deaths. Analysis of previous influenza outbreaks suggests that there are value for seasonal flu. The number of people an infected person passes the virus onto averages about 1.28. This means a group of four people with flu might pass the virus onto five more people. Coronavirus spreads more easily than that. For the Delta variant now surging around the world, R is estimated at about 7. So in the absence of vaccines and other interventions, a single case would infect an average of 7 others. As vaccination programs push on and the virus continues to spread, immunity to coronavirus will drive R down. But how low is a moot point. Coronavirus is more lethal than influenza, largely because vulnerability to the disease rockets in older people. Seasonal influenza killed an estimated 44,505 people in England during the three combined flu seasons from 2015-2016 to 2018-2019. That number died from COVID in England in the first 9 weeks of 2021. A major difference is that the flu figure takes into account the protection of influenza vaccines, where 50% effectiveness is considered good. Coronavirus vaccines should have a greater proportional impact on COVID deaths. So far, the most common COVID vaccines used in the United Kingdom, the Oxford AstraZeneca and the Pfizer-BioNTech shots, reduced the risk of hospitalization from COVID by more than 90%. As a result, the vaccination program has driven COVID deaths down substantially to fewer than 20 a day in the past week. But the vaccines do much more to prevent death than transmission of the virus. So cases of COVID are expected to rise for some time yet. The larger the epidemic grows, the more chance the virus has of finding vulnerable people who have not had their vaccine shots or are not sufficiently protected by the vaccine. While the vaccines dramatically weaken the link between cases and deaths, they are unlikely to break it entirely. The differences between coronavirus, influenza, and the vaccines that target them can easily eclipse a more fundamental issue, though. Learning to live with coronavirus as we live with flu does not mean society can take it in its stride. Every year, a comprehensive global surveillance network detects which variants of influenza are in circulation and most likely to pose a threat in the following season. That information determines which strains go into the annual flu vaccines that are then rolled out in established campaigns. Throughout the flu season, the public health authorities issue case counts and, if needed, update their advice on medical care. There is no such global system for coronavirus as yet. And despite the well-oiled machine that protects the world from flu, the death toll from the virus in a typical year is still substantial. Every winter, flu puts enormous stress on the National Health Service, the NHS, at times pushing it to breaking point. For the health service, living with coronavirus means learning to endure a double wave each winter as coronavirus and flu arrive together. Researchers are working to establish whether the flu jab and a COVID vaccine can be given at the same time as the NHS braces itself for a potential surge in cases of flu this winter. Experts say giving the two shots at the same time could save precious resources for the NHS by avoiding millions of unnecessary appointments. Adam Finn, Professor of Paediatrics at Bristol Medical School and a member of the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization, said, "It isn't actually that difficult to give two injections at the same time. We do this in children all the time. But organizing totally different visits has a massive implication in terms of resources and time and so on." According to surveillance data largely encompassing England compiled by the Royal College of GPs, since the start of the pandemic, lockdowns, social distancing and mask wearing have reduced the risk of contracting not only COVID, but other respiratory bugs as well, such as the flu, cases of which were basically non-existent last winter. Assuming that many of these measures are lifted in the coming months, a resurgence of flu viruses is expected. Graham Medley, a professor at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who chairs the SAGE subgroup on pandemic modelling, said, "I think we absolutely expect that contact rates will not be as low this coming winter as they were last winter. Restrictions will not be as heavy, and as a result, there will be a flu epidemic." Graham Medley said, "And because of the fact we didn't have one last winter, that might be a bit larger, or a lot larger, and I think that's something that focus will turn to as much as COVID in the future." The ComFluCov study is looking at what side effects people get when they are giving when they are given a recommended flu vaccine alongside either the Oxford AstraZeneca or the Pfizer BioNTech jab, as well as the immune responses when the two shots are co-administered. Professor Finn said early results on the side effects when the two jabs are given together had been shared with the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization. The study's chief investigator, Dr. Rayeka Lazarus, a consultant in infectious diseases and microbiology at University Hospitals Bristol and Western NHS Foundation Trust, said, however, the official results are expected by August or September. She said for now, the study is looking at the impact of giving the second COVID dose alongside a flu vaccine, but further research may be needed if a subsequent booster COVID shot is required. Professor Finn said there was a reasonably strong possibility that both the COVID and flu jabs could be administered in one appointment, either this autumn or as part of a program to administer COVID booster shots early next year, or even both. The big question facing researchers on the ComFluCoV study is whether the side effects produced by giving both jabs together are worse than when they are given on their own. Another key question is whether the immunity provided by the two jabs changes when they are administered at the same time. Martin Hibbard, a professor of emerging infectious diseases at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, said one concern is that the immune system could respond to one vaccine more than the other, adding, so you might get a very good response to the COVID vaccine, let's say, but not a very good one to the flu jab, or the other way around. And so, that could be a problem. He added, alternatively, getting the jabs at the same time might boost the immune response to both. Novavax, the COVID vaccine developer that recently published successful late-stage data on its jab, examined a study that has yet to be peer-reviewed, whether its vaccine could be given in tandem with an influenza vaccine. Data showed that co-administered the jabs resulted in no change to influenza vaccine immune response, while a minor reduction in antibody responses from 89.8% to 87.5% was found for the COVID vaccine. Novavax and Moderna are also in the early stages of developing a combined COVID and flu vaccine.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern. I think everyone experiences situations in life where they would rather avoid. Things that they would rather avoid. People they would rather avoid for sure. Whether you're an extrovert or an introvert. Because the thing about being an introvert, there was an interesting quote. It's said that introverts, we don't hate people, we rather when they're not around. But I think it applies to everyone. Sometimes there are things and places and situations and people that they wish they didn't have to encounter or go through because it triggers a level of anxiety, because it makes them feel insecure and uncomfortable, because they feel that it risks their principles and perhaps their values and such would be compromised if they are placed in under certain circumstances. Here's a very, very short yet interesting anecdote. Let's listen to it real quick, and we're going to be right back.
In the name of Allah, the Almighty, dear friends, salamu alaikum. You are listening to the program Lantern from IRIB English Radio. As usual, we have an interesting story at the first step of this episode. Did you know that an eagle can foresee when a storm is approaching long before it breaks? Instead of hiding, the eagle will fly to some high point and wait for the winds to come. When the storm hits, it sets its wings so that the wind can pick it up and lift it above the storm. While the storm rages below, the eagle soars above it. The eagle does not escape or hide from the storm. Instead, it uses the storm to lift it higher. It rises on the stormy winds which others dread. Yes, and what's the moral of the story? When the storm of life or challenges hits, we can rise above them and soar like the eagle which rides the winds of the storm. Don't be afraid of the storms or the challenges in your life. Use it to lift you higher in your life.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Yeah, so basically the eagle, the eagle is referred to in many inspirational stories, and a lot of people, a lot of cultures, and a lot of works of literature, many works of literature, draw much inspiration from this majestic creature, rightfully so. And of course, at the end of the day, like Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, everything is a sign, right? We can learn from everything. Everything is the ayat, the signs of Allah, and there's a reason and purpose for the creation of everything. And if we really contemplate and reflect upon it as instructed by the Holy Quran, there is something that we can learn from even an ant. In the case of what we heard regarding the eagle and how it does not avoid storms and it just flies straight into the eye of the storm and allows the storm to pick it up, which I'm not sure. I'm not an eagle expert, but it would make sense that the eagle, not literally into a storm, but into strong gusts of wind because of the structure of its wings and how huge it is and how effortlessly it can glide through probably unfavorable weather. But here's the thing, right? In case you're wondering, when am I going to stop talking about eagles? No matter what position we have in life, we're going to have to face different weathers. Sometimes life is sunny, wind is mild, everything seems to be going the way we want it to. The odds seem to be in our favor and life is really on track, right? And when life is on track, I'm on track. I'm well composed, I'm polite, I'm kind, I'm amiable, I'm helpful, I'm patient, I'm in a good mood, naturally. But then think about the days that things are a little stormy and less than favorable and keep falling apart. It constantly feels that you're fighting against an invisible current that is bound on knocking you to the ground. and there's this impending situation which you are trying everything to avoid because it makes you really, really anxious or uncomfortable, or you just feel like you can't handle it. There are different aspects to this, but they all boil down to the fact that you gotta face it, you gotta man up, or woman up. There's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam. If anyone thinks that Amir al-Mu'mineen was just a khalifa, or he is just a spiritual guide, or he's just this beautiful shrine in Najaf, then I think they haven't really understood Amir al-Mu'mineen. Amir al-Mu'mineen was a mystic, he was a mathematician, he was a politician, he was a philosopher, he was a physician, he was a psychologist, he was an interpreter of the Quran, he was a warrior, he was a farmer, a gardener, a father, a brother, a ruler. He was like all in one package. The incredible person who is Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. And there's a hadith from His Eminence where he says, I'm paraphrasing of course, if you dread something, face it. And even psychologists tell us, especially to those who suffer from anxiety, that the more you try to avoid something that makes you anxious, something that makes you tense and ticky and uncomfortable, the bigger that sense of anxiety toward it and that gloom and doom, and the scarier that thing is going to be. But once you actually approach it and get it done, over and done with, you're going to realize that, hey, it wasn't that, you know, big of a mountain to climb after all. And the reason, or the how we can make that possible, is in really understanding that لا يكلف الله نفسا إلا وسعها. Allah truly does not burden a soul, a person, a heart, a mind with more than it can bear. And this verse has been used out of context, I've seen very often. People sometimes use this verse to avoid responsibilities that life just thrusts onto them by saying, well, I can't handle this, I'm not going to do this. God said, yeah, I won't burden you with more than you can bear. So, and then they bail out. But how about looking at it this way? The fact that it is now in your life and it has become your burden means that Allah knew you could bear it. Thank you for being with us on today's episode of The Lantern. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillah
tatma'innul qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.